Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author had been studying the mammals in her yard, the chipmunks, squirrels, and now the woodchuck, whom she had named Fat Mama. We resume Suburban Safari on page 78, and this is episode 8. Now that I'm studying the ecology of my yard, it's dawning on me that woodchucks are real native animals who don't deserve to be hounded. The woodchuck's wild animal status was driven home again when I came across a reproduction of a bill of goods from an old trading post. The prices of goods, shirt with ruffles, tobacco, etc., were listed in animal skins, and to my surprise, 300 years ago, you could buy more shirts with a woodchuck pelt than with a beaver pelt. That must mean that they were more rare. That puzzled me until I remembered that the land was almost entirely forested until Europeans got serious about logging and farming in the 1800s. Although woodchucks will use forest for winter denning, they do their summer eating in open fields. The European pastures and the backyards that evolved from them over the past century were a woodchuck's dream come true. Their population must have exploded, along with the population of cows and horses. Now they're anything but rare, and most people asked to place a value on them would name a number deep in the red. Squirrels and cheeky aside, most mammals, who do well in the suburbs and cities, do their thing at night, when people and dogs are less likely to bug them. I'm not keen on spending my nights among the mosquitoes, waiting for animals to come out and exhibit their natural history. Fortunately, there are other ways of getting the lay of the nighttime land. One is the roadkill survey. A late winter road with black and white carcasses reminds me that skunks are rousing themselves in preparation for mating. If it's late spring and the road killed have ringed tails, I'm reminded that year-old male raccoons are dispersing from their mother's territory to make their fortune. It's nice to know that roadkill isn't a total waste of life. It can be educational. A less gruesome means of counting noses is to set traps. I head into the yard with a bucket of playground sand and spread it every place where animal traffic has worn a ditch under the fence or pushed up the wire. I also set up a scent post. This is a shallow aluminum tray filled with sand. Jabbed through it and into the ground is a dowel. Atop the dowel is a blob of the universal attractant, peanut butter. With the sand traps, every morning is like Christmas. I scuttle out to see what I've caught. Unless it rained in the night, there's always something in the traps. Crouching to put the sand between me and the slanting sunlight, I see topography in the sand. A long hand with claw holes at the end is a skunk's front foot. Also clawed, but with a ridge between the pudgy heel and the pudgy ball, is the skunk's hind foot. Two rows of tiny scuffs with a snaky tail track in between record the crossing of a mouse. A tight ring of small craters is a cat track. A slug's slime trail has curled into a sandy tube. Bird feet make delicate pitchfork shapes. A thread-thin line of minuscule dents marks the progress of an insect. The longer I look, the more I see. The rusting fence has snagged a hare. It's long and multicolored, like one of the stray cats who stalks my birds. Now I notice an aging feather, then another, then white bones matted with more plumage. An old bird kill. At the scent post, the tracks are all over each other. Squirrels, whose hands are larger than I'd have guessed, were up early. One of them I can identify with certainty. Stumpy's peg leg left round dents in the sand. Not every nocturnal is shy. If I left my door open at night, I think the skunks might come right in. One evening, a dog that I'm babysitting growls out through the dining room screen. Beside the deck steps, a bucket is rocking. A trowel clangs. I step outside, leaving the light off. Looking over the railing, I see at first only white blots in the flower bed. As my eyes adjust, I can make out two tiny skunk kits wrestling like, well, kittens. They untangle themselves and mosey through the plants, their airy tails standing tall. At the corner of the deck, one turns left to visit the neighbor's dog. The other putters along in the flowers, a tad jumpy without his sibling. A screen door slams down the street, and he hops stiffly around to aim his tail at the noise. He thinks better of it and shuffles back to point his ears at the sound. His face is a triangle with glittering black eyes. A white stripe runs up each flank. His legs are stiff, giving him the locomotion of a stuffed toy. A leaf crackles in the bamboo wilderness, and he hops around to face that. No, better to aim the tail. I'm kneeling on the deck now, and he's directly below me. "Hello, little stunky." He peers up, blinks. Then he noses through the leaves and noodles away down the fence line. Later in the summer, I meet one of these fellows again. I'm sitting in the dark, listening for mice and feeding the mosquitoes. When a black and white blot the size of a football bobbles past in the grass, silently I get up and follow. He moves slowly, nose to the ground. Skunks have weak eyesight, but good noses and strong claws that rip Japanese beetle grubs out of the ground. He stops and digs hard. While his head is down, I move in for a closer look. He digs again, and I move to within 10 feet. He digs by the shed and turns himself around. Now absorbed in his work, he's meandering back in my direction. He's 8 feet away, then 6. I'm half crouched to see him better. I'm being perforated by mosquitoes, and I'm in a quandary. Should I let him know I'm here? Or might he go past without noticing? An adult skunk can fling yellow oil 10 feet. I've seen one fling it over his own back and into the face of my dear departed hound. The guy coming my way is only half-grown, but I'm sure he's capable of slagging his sulfur 6 feet. A friend who got skunked once told me that you burn your clothes and prepare for 2 weeks of strangers in checkout lines griping about an odor. "Ahem," I say softly. The skunk raises his head and stares. "It's okay, Stunky. Put your tail down and no one will get hurt." He isn't convinced. He stamps his back feet. "Oh, no need for that. Nice skunk, pretty skunk." What am I wearing and how will it burn? Stunky's head weaves from side to side, and then he makes a break for it. He turns and stiff legs into the tall grass by the shed. He stops with his tail sticking out. "Thank you, Stunky." The tail disappears. I swat 17 mosquitoes. In a moment, Stunky emerges from the far side of the shed, fully recovered. He zigzags across the dark lawn, digging in the moonlight. The mulch under the raspberries crackles. Then his white stripes disappear under the back fence. They glow once more under the neighbor's lilac, and Stunky is gone. I'm not particular about holes in my turf, and I have no affection for Japanese beetles, so I have nearly no objection to skunks. I often babysit other people's dogs, but if I turn the deck light on before letting the dogs out at night, confrontations are avoided. I do, however, have an issue with skunk poo. One of my dog friends found some and rolled in it, and it really doesn't get much worse. It's just as powerful as the yellow oil, but in a far more offensive form. Still, it's an opportunity to learn about Stunky's diet, So one day I pinch my nose and collect a sample in a plastic bag. I slide it under the microscope. It's a mass of intertwined insect parts. Brown antennae curve around shards of mahogany shell. Dark mandibles pinch earwig tails, which in turn pinch wings. They're from modest-sized insects, these parts. Stunky must have to eat all night. My biophilia complex does not fire up to the extent that I want to kiss the skunk, but I do notice that if I put food out that the crows don't care for, or that is simply too terrifying for them to approach, it disappears overnight. I like to think I'm feeding the Japanese beetle eradication corps. As much time as I spend outside at night, I hear precious few mice. They're alleged to be supernumerary in lots of ecosystems, ubiquitous as ants. But even their tracks are rare in my sand traps. It's a puzzle. One summer evening, when Chuck Lubelchick comes by to set the mosquito trap, he also brings a sack of special biologist mouse traps. They're square tubes of aluminum with a flap door in one end. We coat gobs of peanut butter and rolled oats and drop a gob into each trap. Chuck says mice travel with the edges of things wherever possible, so we set the traps against the fence, the house, and the shed. Put them all in the shade first thing in the morning, Chuck says. Those traps get hot. And I just want to prepare you. If we catch shrews, they'll probably be dead by morning. Their metabolism is so high, they literally starve to death in a few hours. We get no shrews. When I nip out to check the traps in the morning, 5 have shut. I rotate one slowly so I can peek in the door without opening it wide. 4 white feet appear. Another trap shifts in my hand when I pick it up. The other 3 are false alarms. Empty. We've probably bagged white-footed mice, but deer mice look nearly identical, gray on top, white below. Both are native, unlike the brown house mouse. When Chuck arrives, he pulls on blue surgical gloves. Mice can carry hantavirus, a rip-snorting respiratory bug. He upends a trap over a skinny plastic bag. The mouse hits bottom and heads back up, but Chuck is already clipping the bag to a scale, about 2/3 of an ounce. He reaches in to catch the mouse's tail. It's a male. Chuck lowers him onto the step, then runs a thumb and finger down his spine until he's got the mouse by the scruff. He lifts him up and begins ruffling his fur with tweezers, looking for parasites. The mouse hangs quietly, silken whiskers waving a little. The ears and eyes are large, for nocturnal use, Chuck notes. He's poking behind the mouse's ear, a favorite spot for ticks. He finds none there, nor among the whiskers, a sensitive area that mice are loath to scratch. A deer tick would be especially interesting to find in light of its role in transmitting Lyme disease. I've never seen a deer tick here before, but Chuck has vials of alcohol at the ready. Now, here's an unexpected thing about mice. They are less likely to aid and abet in giving me Lyme disease if my surroundings support a lot of other small mammals. The bacterium that causes Lyme disease lives in a lot of little critters. But of all of them, white-footed mice are best at passing the bacterium to a biting tick. So the more mice you have, the more likely it is that your local ticks will carry Lyme disease. However, if for every mouse in your neighborhood there are 10 other small mammals for ticks to choose from, then the odds of a tick biting an infected mouse plummet. So the rate of infected ticks goes down. And, drum roll please, the rate of infected people goes down. At least, that's the conclusion of a couple of studies, both preliminary. It sounds reasonable to me. It's one more reason to roll out the welcome mat for Stunky, the squirrels, and the rest of the fur-bearers. Later, when I'm wondering what the mice have done for me lately, I stumble across another curious fact. Mice help distribute special fungal spores. These fungi grow on the roots of trees, helping them gather nutrients from soil. Mice eat the fungal spores here and poop them there, helping spread them from tree to tree. Mice serve their ecosystem in other ways, too. They disperse plant seeds when they stash them for winter, and they're a staple in the diet of small carnivores ranging from foxes and coyotes to birds, bobcats, and snakes. In my yard, the adults are probably eaten by cats, while the babies may be taken by skunks and possums. Chuck dumps out our second mouse. This one is female. Normally, they're loaded with fleas, but these seem kind of clean, he complains. On cue, a tiny flea hops onto his glove. Like the first, this mouse hangs quietly as Chuck works it over. Some of them will actually start grooming, washing themselves. While you're holding them, he says with a grin, you just get used to that. Then one lays into you. We carry the mouse to the back fence where she was caught. You ready to go back? Chuck asks, and strokes her head twice. Her feet hit the ground and she springs into the brush pile. It's a completely different world at night, Chuck muses, looking around. Most people have no concept of what's out here in the dark. As sappy as we humans are about a furry face, our day-to-day relationship with urban and suburban mammals is often a struggle. We crave the contact, then often too late we see the warts, or the ticks, or the holes in our house. When I visited England recently, I learned that foxes roam English towns. How cute that must be, thought I. I wish foxes roamed my town. And then I got the details. The urban foxes abandon their social structure, their dawn and dusk schedule, and their natural diet. They raid garbage cans in daylight and live short, scruffy lives. But boy, I bet they were cute when they first arrived, and I can imagine the rapture of the first English urbanites who set out a dish of cat food to lure them closer. Anthony DiNicola, a wildlife ecologist who deals with animals who have worn out their welcome, says it often takes a decade for our feelings about a newly suburbanized mammal to progress from awe to awful. By 10 generations, the fear of man is almost gone in the animal, he explains. And then people tell me, we'd love anything you could do to kill them. It's sad. You set the animal up. You provide an easy food source. The animal habituates. And then you persecute it. Tony is not your average PhD ecologist. For one thing, most ecologists I know look as if they got their last haircut from another ecologist who had 5 minutes and a Leatherman. Tony wears a crew cut and looks like a Marine. For another thing, instead of laboring in academia, he runs a nonprofit company called White Buffalo. And an awful lot of White Buffalo's business is sharpshooting extra deer in the suburbs. He also researches deer contraceptives. Deer culling is a nasty business, and that's mainly because we Homo sapiens are so confused about how close we want to be to nature and about what nature should look like. As a rule, we focus our adoration and our money on a few creatures that scientists call charismatic megafauna. That's Latinate for big, cute animals. Deer qualify. Accordingly, animal rights activists sometimes disrupt Tony's work. If he were to spend his evenings killing locusts, I doubt anyone would protest. Yet locusts are what white-tailed deer become when they enter the suburbs. You can't blame them for coming. People create ideal deer habitat in their backyards. Hunters don't intrude on this grassy, shrubby Eden, so the deer descend, and if people don't throw rocks at them, they eat the place bare. Batting their long eyelashes and swiveling their cute jaws, they grind and swallow everything from maple trees to rhododendrons and pansies. Then they frolic into the streets to fold up like origami against the bumper of an automobile. Personally, I'd rather have Tony drop a deer with one shot to the head than see the animal eat itself into starvation or die of ruptured organs by the roadside. No question. I guess in my ideal world, coyotes, wolves, cougars, and predatory humans would be plentiful enough to eat the extra deer, and we wouldn't have to make this choice. But the reality is that suburban deer experience an unnaturally low rate of predation. Another fact is that we humans don't like deer stripping our azaleas or playing speed bump on our roads. Given that, shooting them is currently the only affordable solution. The deer culled by white buffalo are given to food banks, which must make them one of the most environmentally friendly foods in America today. These free-range animals live off the fat of the land, demanding no truckloads of corn and generating no stockyards of manure. They're local, so the meat needn't be trucked 1,000 miles. If the suburbs are producing high-quality food for low-income people, I guess I'm all for it. Perhaps I digress. There's a chance my ideal world will come to pass, giving me the opportunity to see if life with large predators is really so blissful. Those carnivores are finding their way into the suburbs in many parts of North America. I was thrilled when I came across a New York Times article about cougars stalking the mule deer of suburban Boulder. Even though the cougars kill pets and stalk people, the Times reported, many people empathize with the cats and forgive them. They don't report the naughty lions to authorities for fear of the lion being punished. Lured by fat deer, the article noted, the cats are moving east. It's predicted they'll soon reach New Jersey. The Times may be behind the times. Since cougars were hunted out of the eastern and midwestern states by European settlers, they've been a western phenomenon. As coyotes did, cougars are now spreading. For many years, wildlife officials dismissed cougar sightings in my neck of the woods as either hallucinations or sightings of released pets. And in many cases, they were probably right. But when I locate a map showing confirmed cougar sightings in the east, I simply can't believe they all were pets. Some of the animals were seen with kittens, which seems highly unpet-like. Wildlife officials are reconsidering the situation, although a prudent investigator would have to admit we may never know for sure where these cougars are coming from. They are coming, however. When I click on my own state's map at www.easterncougarnet.org, I find 5 dots. An inland spot marks the place where a hunter watched a mother and kitten for 20 minutes. Then officials later confirmed the tracks. A mid-coast spot denotes 2 more confirmed sightings. Way up at the Quebec border, a hunter said he watched a mother and 2 kittens. Wardens later classified the tracks as probable cougar prints. And what's this circle right on top of my house? I had forgotten. In 1995, a woman in the next town saw a cougar drinking from a pond. DNA testing on hair from the site confirmed her diagnosis. It shouldn't surprise me. Cape Elizabeth is one of those towns that has suburbanized just enough to have large, luscious lots and little room for hunters. The results are typical. 1 out of 3 car accidents in the Cape involves a white-tailed deer. The town's few remaining farmers are battling the animals with tooth, claw, and electric fence. And the predators are coming. Cape Elizabeth has what some would call a coyote problem and what I would call a good start. And it has definitely had at least 1 cougar. Not living in a western suburb, not confronting predatory eyes in my driveway at night, I admit that my opinion isn't worth much when it comes to the joy of living cheek by jowl with large meat eaters. And I'll confess that I'm not suited to living in fear. In the long term, it gives me indigestion. And in the short term, I'm prone to exactly those panicky squeaks and lurches that make a big cat's heart sore. But regardless of what I think, they're coming. The chubby deer are attracting them, and the people aren't repelling them. For the first time in many centuries, people aren't shooting every wolf, coyote, and cougar they set eyes on. For the first time in many generations of these mammals, it's fairly safe to be near people. So now we're going to find out how safe it is for people to be near those animals. Maybe if we can control our collective squeaking and lurching, they'll help clear the streets of extra deer. And if returning predators display an appetite for big fat mama and Stumpy and Cheeky, all's fair in love and war, I suppose. If I had to choose, I'd much prefer to see Cheeky's copper pelt swallowed by a wild cat than a house cat. Chapter 5. The Army of Earth Movers. Eek! Working at my desk, I didn't realize Cheeky the Chipmunk was around until I felt his claws on my bare thigh. I jumped, which made him skitter behind a pile of books. But he's a resilient guy. He springs to my lap again, then hops onto the desk, where his seed cup awaits. In he goes. To keep him acclimated to human movements, I lift the cup and slowly spin my swivel chair. He thinks that's weird, but not so weird that it spoils his appetite. It's bad enough that I spin the chipmunk and sweet-talk the woodchuck. Today I developed feelings for a slug. If this continues, I'll be unable to step outdoors at all for fear of crushing a native mold spore. I have to admit, even before meeting the slug, I had this sort of concern. Each time I sit in a lawn chair, I cringe to think how many little citizens those plastic feet are crushing. Crossing the lawn, I'm hyper-aware of my own 2 feet. What did I kill this time? What now? It matters, I think. My squirrels and my Cheeky depend on healthy plants. My birds need insects, which also require healthy plants. Healthy plants, in turn, need good soil, and good soil is busy soil. A slug may be the gardener's nemesis, but like the umptillion other species of creepy crawlies in my yard, slugs improve my soil. They and the other denizens of dirt help my soil to hold a title I never expected it to win. Suburban soil, despite the insults we heap on it, may be in better shape than the soil at the neighborhood farm. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We are reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.